Welcome to In the Hive, I'm Roger McDonough. Last week on the show, we looked at the plans to overhaul America's land-based nuclear missiles. Utah's Hill Air Force Base will play host to the Mission Integration Facility, which will serve as a kind of headquarters for the development and ongoing sustainment of the country's new nuclear missiles.
It's only been really in the last about 7 years has the discussion and the activities associated with recapitalizing our ICBM force, and this project, we call it the Ground-Based Strategic Deterrent, has been here at Hill Air Force Base sort of under the radar. And as recently as this last fall in September, we awarded Northrop Grumman a $13.3 billion development contract, and we are fast at really building this organization and quite a bit of work up here in northern Utah to begin in earnest the development and the replacement of our ICBMs.
That's Colonel Jason Bartolome, director of the Ground-Based Strategic Deterrent Systems Directorate with the U.S. Air Force's Nuclear Weapons Center up at Hill Air Force Base. You can hear my full conversation with him on last week's episode of the show. Right now, America's ICBMs, the Minuteman III missiles, are in known missile silos in Montana, North Dakota, and Wyoming. A number of them are constantly on high alert, sometimes called hair trigger alert, allowing the President of the United States to launch them very quickly and with no oversight. But the Minuteman III missiles are also nearly 60 years old. The $83 billion plan that is now in the works is for military contractor Northrop Grumman to replace all of those missiles with the new missiles over the next couple of decades. The actual use of nuclear weapons is an extremely frightening prospect, because nuclear weapons are both incredibly powerful and because of the radiation that they emit and the radioactive fallout that results from their use. Tens of thousands of people died almost instantly when the U.S. dropped bombs on the cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki during the Second World War. Tens of thousands more died over the months that followed from the effects of burns and radiation sickness. Closer to home, between 1945 and 1992, the United States conducted more than 1,000 nuclear weapons tests, nearly 200 of those above ground in the atmosphere. And the radiation fallout from those tests resulted in cancers and other diseases that led to an undetermined number of deaths across the United States. For example, in 1997, the National Cancer Institute said that 200,000 cases of thyroid cancer were linked to fallout from nuclear explosions at the Nevada test site. And as the Utah playwright and downwinder advocate Mary Dixon has pointed out, that's just one form of cancer linked to the above-ground tests.
Dum dum, deedle dum dum, deedle dum dum, deedle dum dum. There was a turtle by the name of Bert, and Bert.
Last week on this show, we also heard a bit from Eric Schlosser, author of the book Command and Control: Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety. The Illusion of Safety is sort of at the core of the song you're hearing in the background here that you may or may not be familiar with, depending on what era you grew up in.
Be sure and remember what Bert the Turtle just did, friends, because every one of us must remember to do the same thing.
That's Bert the Turtle, a sort of public service mascot who appeared on the nation's TVs back in 1952. Duck and cover was what students, well, what everyone was taught to do in the eventuality of a nuclear strike.
We all know the atomic bomb is very dangerous. Since it may be used against us, we must get ready for it, just as we are ready for many other dangers that are around us all the time. Fire is a danger. It can burn whole buildings if someone is careless. But we are ready for fires. We have a fine fire department to put out the fire. And you have fire.
The Illusion of Safety is part of the subtitle of the book Command and Control by the author Eric Schlosser, a book that documents an absurd amount of nuclear accidents that happened or that almost happened. The book is not so much a cautionary tale as it is a blaring alarm about the existential threat to all humanity posed by nuclear weapons.
You might be out playing at home when the warning comes. Then be sure to get into the house fast where your parents have fixed a safe place for you to go.
I spoke with Eric Schlosser last week. Eric Schlosser, thank you very much for making time for this.
Thanks for having me.
Eric, for our listeners, you know, so far they will have heard about plans to overhaul the Minuteman III intercontinental ballistic missiles, the plan to replace those missiles with something new under the title Ground-Based Strategic Deterrent Program. Just before we talk about investing in a new system, one part of your book, Command and Control, talks about just how old the Minuteman missiles are. Can you sort of lay that out for us? Just, I don't know, how decrepit those missiles are, if that makes sense?
Well, the silos and the launch complexes for the Minuteman were designed during the Kennedy administration and built during the Kennedy administration. So that makes them more than half a century old. And these locations were chosen at the height of the Cold War, when it was assumed that the missiles would be used against the Soviet Union. So that's why they're located where they're located. And that's a real problem in the 21st century, because if you want to hit a target outside of Russia, you still have to fly over Russia with one of these missiles. And you cannot assume that Vladimir Putin and the Russians are going to know that that missile is going somewhere else and not going to Moscow. So when you think about whether or not to have a ground-based strategic deterrent, the first question should be, why would you put the missiles in locations that were selected 50 to 60 years ago for war with the Soviet Union? The next question would be, why would you have a missile that cannot be moved? Both Russia and China have missiles, and North Korea have missiles that are mobile. So we're never 100% sure of where they are, which makes it more difficult to destroy those missiles. If you put the new missiles in the United States into silos that are 50 to 60 years old, everyone knows where they're located, and they could be easily destroyed. They could be destroyed not only by Russian nuclear weapons, but they could be destroyed by domestic terrorists. And one of the things that's extraordinary, and I've driven around the missile fields, the Minuteman missile fields, is most of these missiles are located in areas surrounded by private land. In Russia and China, they put their missiles on military bases. In the United States, our Minuteman missiles are in silos that have thousands of acres of farmland surrounding them. What that means is there are 5,000 miles of cables that link our launch control centers with our missile silos. And those cables are going across private land. These missiles are so vulnerable to sabotage, and now increasingly to being hacked into.
Right. But cybersecurity threats, I mean, you talked about destroying them, you know, in advance. Of course, there's just the idea that they could simply be made inoperative by a stealthy hack.
Right. And the idea of hacking into our nuclear command and control system sounds like the plot of an old Hollywood movie, but it is a real concern. And people much smarter than me and with much more knowledge of this issue are deeply, deeply concerned about it. So I think the question that should be posed to supporters of the ground-based strategic deterrent is, if you were going to start from scratch, would you really locate these missile silos where they are right now? The answer would be no. Would you really use 5,000 miles of cable to connect them to the launch centers that's going over private land? And I think the answer would be no. One of the defenses of using these old silos today is that it turns the upper Midwest into a warhead sink. And believe it or not, what that strategy is that it's drawing an attack on the United States, on the heartland of the United States. And the logic is that in order to destroy these missiles, the Russians or the Chinese would have to attack the heartland of the United States. And by attacking the heartland of the United States, they would guarantee an overwhelmingly destructive retaliation by American nuclear weapons. But if that's the logic, then why not put one missile in New York City, one missile in Washington, D.C., and maybe three missiles in, well, I was going to make a joke about a city I don't like, but yeah. But if your goal is to invite an attack on the United States in order to threaten a retaliation, you don't need 400 missiles to do that.
This is a different topic altogether, but you know, you talked about the rationale behind doing it the way we've been doing it, putting them in the same silos. Former Defense Secretary William Perry at one point argued against the development of this program altogether, saying that it would lead essentially to a new arms race with Russia and China because it would be, despite those drawbacks that you're describing, it would be a leap forward in terms of speed and accuracy. Is an arms race where we're headed?
I think that we're in the arms race, and Bill Perry is extraordinary, and he's one of the few people alive today who was in a position of authority at the height of the Cold War. So he knows this from firsthand experience. And one of Bill Perry's greatest concerns is that when missiles are vulnerable to attack, like these ground-based missiles would be, you're under enormous pressure to use them or lose them. And again, this sounds like the plot of a Hollywood movie, but that creates an enormous risk of accidental nuclear war. Right now, the United States has the capacity to launch our Minuteman missiles under warning. That means that these missiles could be launched simply when there is a warning that the United States is under attack. And we've had a number of, you know, false alarms from our early warning system. One of the unusual and unique aspects about these Minuteman missiles is once they're launched, they cannot be called back. And one of the arguments that Perry makes that I think is very convincing is that nuclear submarines are hidden beneath the ocean and therefore are under no immediate pressure to launch their missiles. There's much more time available for decision making. If it looks like the United States is under attack and it turns out to be a false alarm, these submarines hidden beneath the ocean don't have to launch their missiles. The same is true for our bombers. Once bombers get off the ground, if it turns out to be a false alarm, you can order them to return to their base. But because of the vulnerability of the Minuteman, there's enormous pressure to launch the missiles if there's a fear that they're about to be destroyed. And what you want during a nuclear crisis is you want as much time as possible for decision-making. So I think as I've said earlier, I think the advocates of the ground-based strategic deterrent need to make a case for why missiles should be put in silos that are more than half a century old with cables that are vulnerable to disruption, with a missile, with a weapon system that could potentially cause an accidental nuclear war.
It's a terrifying prospect, and I mean, I guess the it begs a question that you may not be able to answer, but which is why, you know, we have the nuclear triad. We have land, we have sea, we have air. Why do we have to have the triad? I mean, why is having... The question I have is, why is it happening?
Yeah, it's happening because it's very hard to break out of old molds of thinking. And these are weapons that were carefully, skillfully, brilliantly designed for the last war, for the Cold War. And by the way, they're actually excellent weapons for a surprise attack on Russia because they can be launched within minutes. They travel extremely quickly and they're very, very accurate. And if you're not worried about them being destroyed, but you want to use them as a surprise attack, they're excellent for that reason. I think that just the fact that they're being located in these 60-year silos show you that they're a legacy of the Cold War.
Yeah.
The other reason that there's such pressure to build them is that it's a multi-billion dollar program. It will bring billions of dollars to Hill Air Force Base and to Montana and North Dakota. And the senators of these states strongly support them. I would hope that if you're looking for federal funding for economic development, that you could find other projects that wouldn't put a bullseye on your state and invite a nuclear attack on your state. Because again, these targets, these missiles are sitting ducks. There's no way to defend them.
Can we zoom out and talk about something that I think most people rarely, if ever, think about, which is the concept of deterrence, the sort of baffling idea behind nuclear weapons that, look, we don't want to use them. We don't ever want to use them. In general, they are not supposed to be used because it's sort of unfathomable what nuclear war would look like. I guess, do you want to describe that? I mean,
the whole realm of nuclear strategy has all kinds of phrases that are innocuous sounding that are actually designed to hide what they really mean. Nuclear deterrence is another way of saying hostage taking. Right now, the United States is threatening to kill, essentially, the civilians of Russia if Russia attacks us. And Russia is doing the same thing to the United States. Nuclear deterrence is a threat to annihilate your enemy if they attack you with nuclear weapons. It's very much like medieval hostage taking. One of the sad things about deterrence is that it usually works. I think that nuclear deterrence played a major role in preventing a war with the Soviet Union. I think nuclear deterrence played a major role in preventing World War III. The problem with nuclear deterrence is that it works until it doesn't. It's not like a brick wall that prevents, someone with a spear from climbing over it. It's a psychological defense, and it only works against people who have a desire to live. We now have adversaries that celebrate the killing of civilians and are willing to die for it. And nuclear deterrence was never designed for that kind of adversary. Nuclear deterrence was also created as a theory when there was a superpower rivalry between the United States and the Soviet Union, who basically controlled all the nuclear weapons in the world. And now there are seven other countries that have nuclear weapons. And so you have a much, much more complex nuclear rivalry. You have India and Pakistan and China, the old nuclear powers of France, and the United Kingdom. You also have Israel, North Korea. And this is a much more challenging, much more complex dynamic, which calls into question whether nuclear weapons are relevant at all in the 21st century. So I think we need to be asking much more basic questions about why we have these weapons, how they might be used, and what's the theory behind them in the 21st century, and not just rebuilding an arsenal that has its intellectual origins really in the 1950s.
I want to ask a couple of questions that brings to mind. One is, there was a period of time when the concept of eliminating nuclear weapons from the Earth seemed far more feasible. There was a lot of public will around the world to do just that. This was, of course, in the aftermath of the use of these weapons on the world stage. Could you just talk about when that happened, how it happened, and why it didn't happen?
Yeah. I'm actually encouraged about the possibility of abolishing nuclear weapons. In January of 2021, the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons was formally ratified. It's been ratified by more than 50 countries. And what that means, it's a United Nations treaty. Under international law, nuclear weapons are now illegal. And the next step is enforcing that law. The United States has committed itself already by treaty under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Act to work towards abolishing nuclear weapons. And as more and more countries obtain these weapons, the danger that they're going to be used increases. And I think that if a city anywhere in the world is destroyed by a nuclear weapon, whether it's during a war or a terrorist attack, the iPhone and smartphone images of the aftermath are going to lead much more promptly to the abolition of nuclear weapons. So in saying that I support the abolition of nuclear weapons, I don't mean I support unilateral American disarmament tomorrow. Because if you get back to the whole strategy of deterrence or hostage taking, I think that these weapons right now do prevent attacks, but they do so at what I believe to be a risk that's much, much too high. And so we need to seriously be negotiating with the other major nuclear powers to reduce the risk and reduce the number of weapons, not to spend $1.5-2 trillion, you know, modernizing an arsenal whose intellectual origins are in the 1950s. And one last point, 90%, more than 90% of the nuclear weapons in the world are possessed by two countries, the United States and Russia. And we need those two countries to sit down and begin meaningful negotiations to reduce their arsenals even further, and then bring China into those negotiations to reduce the threat. Literally, it sounds so like hyperbole, reduce the threat that mankind will be wiped off the face of the earth.
Your book is replete with many numbers of incidents of near accidents and of accidents that were fatal, and that became, you know, close to being much more fatal. And you know, these are the so-called broken arrows, nuclear warheads that befell some kind of incident. I'm going to direct people to the book for the full litany of near misses. Do you want to choose an example that highlights just how close we have come to the brink and kind of lay that out for us?
Yeah. In January of 1961, a B-52 bomber broke apart over North Carolina, and one of its very powerful hydrogen bombs went through all of its proper arming steps except one. And if it had gone through one more step, if one switch had been triggered, there would have been a major nuclear detonation in North Carolina that would have sent deadly radioactive fallout up the East Coast right after John F. Kennedy was inaugurated. And I've held in my hand at the Sandia National Laboratory the switch that saved us from catastrophe. And this sounds like an exaggeration, but you probably wouldn't be allowed to use that switch in your house today under the Underwriter Laboratories rules. I mean, this was the most rudimentary, simple switch that had failed in other weapons and had been known to fail in other weapons. So we were saved from catastrophe in that one instance by the skill of the weapons designers, but also by luck. And that's been found again and again and again. And I one final point, I've spent an enormous amount of time with the Air Force, and I've spent an enormous amount of time with the officers who have command and control of our nuclear weapons. I have tremendous respect for them. They do not fit the Hollywood stereotype of mad bombers eager to start World War III. And so none of my criticism of our current nuclear strategy applies to the officers who serve, who have an incredibly stressful job overseeing weapons that are out of date and aging and are prone to accidents.
I got to tell you, ignorance is bliss. The idea that, you know, knowing about this from your book makes it much more difficult to not think about it pretty frequently. Do you ever sleep, Eric Schlosser?
I sleep quite well, and I think it's always better to know. And it's when you're living in denial that real problems come up and bite you. And certainly in the nuclear weapon safety issue, it was the denial of safety problems and the refusal to look clearly at what those problems were that almost led to the accidental loss of American cities through nuclear detonations. So it's better to know. And once you know, it's good to do something about it.
There's the idea that also from Hollywood that on the process that the President of the United States, whoever she or he may be, has the sole authority to launch a nuclear strike. And that is the case, correct? And there's not really room for intervening in a strike once it's been put in motion. Is that correct?
Yeah. The president of the United States has the sole authority to use nuclear weapons. And under the law, no one else in the chain of command can overrule him if he or she is just deciding to start a nuclear war. Now, that order could be prevented, but it would be an act of mutiny. And the cabinet might be able to say that the president of the United States had been mentally incapacitated and removed from power. That would be a legal way to do it.
If they got the chance to, right? I mean,
if they got the chance to. But it would really take, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Secretary of Defense, and other officers to disobey this command. They might say that the command was illegal because the command was in violation of international law, regarding the killing of civilians or something like that. But it would be a very difficult thing to do. People brought this up under President Trump because he, seemed to have a temper and he didn't always seem to be behaving in a rational way. But I think it applies just as strongly under President Biden. In the military, there always need to be two people around the command systems of nuclear weapons. And I think there needs to be a two-man rule for the President of the United States, or a two-person rule around the President of the United States. That authorization needs to be signed off on by someone else.
Eric Schlosser, journalist and author of the book Command and Control: Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety. He's also the author of a number of other notable works. Eric Schlosser, thank you for making time for this.
Okay, great to talk to you.
Eric Schlosser's book is a gripping, if at times difficult, read. 500 pages with 110 pages of footnotes on top of that. It's also a very thoroughly researched book. Open it up at random, and you're sure to come across something noteworthy. For example, just before recording this, I opened up to page 312 and read about an incident that happened on December 5th, 1962. I'm going to do my best book on tape excerpt here. The weapon accidents often felt sudden and surreal. On December 5th, 1965, a group of sailors were pushing an A-4E Skyhawk fighter plane onto an elevator aboard the USS Ticonderoga, an aircraft carrier about 70 miles off the coast of Japan. The plane's canopy was open. Lieutenant Douglas M. Webster, its pilot, strapped into his seat. The deck rose as the ship passed over a wave, and one of the sailors blew a whistle, signaling that Webster should apply his brakes. Webster didn't hear the whistle. The plane started to roll backward. The sailor kept blowing the whistle. Other sailors yelled, "Brakes! Brakes!" and held onto the plane. They let go as it rolled off the elevator into the sea. In an instant, it was gone. The pilot, his plane, and a Mark 43 hydrogen bomb vanished. No trace of them was ever found. The ocean there was about 3 miles deep. You've been listening to In the Hive from KCPW, a listener-supported, entirely independent, local public radio resource. Podcasts are available out there for you to find. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for tuning in. Both Sides of the Aisle is coming up next.